This is Director Chris Rodriguez of the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, and I want to welcome you to Season 2 of Intelligence Unclassified. This season, we are refocusing our episodes to better reflect NJOHSP's three core mission areas: counterterrorism, cybersecurity, and emergency preparedness. We'll be pulling both local and national experts in all these fields in an effort to discuss New Jersey's diverse threat landscape and to offer you a unique perspective on current homeland security trends and issues. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. Please feel free to add this podcast to your RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow us on Twitter at NJOHSP and Facebook. All links can be found in the show notes and on our website, www.njhomelandsecurity.gov.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Dean Barada from the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. We are wrapping up our observations of the International Studies Association conference that took place in Baltimore from the 22nd to the 25th of February. This is our third take of this one. The first one we did in the car on the way back from the conference. The sound wasn't great, and we were kind of distracted by driving. And we just tried to do a second take, but didn't have the microphone plugged in. So we're hoping third time's the charm here. So with me are my partners in crime for the conference, Angie and Paige, who are two of the analysts here. And without further ado, I'll pass it over to Paige to talk about the first panel that she saw.
Okay, so hello, everyone. I went to a really interesting panel. One of the speakers spoke about jihad, miracles, propaganda by a researcher named Alexander De La Paz. So he talked about miracles in terms of ISIS messaging, right? So miracles exist in a myriad of different religions, from Christianity to Islam to Judaism. And he basically defined miracles as gifts or favors from God, generally in the form of violations of the laws of nature, and specifically incidents of low probability. So they're not happening all the time. So he looked at basically Sunni militant organizations, but specifically ISIS, and he looked at different types of media that talk about miracles. So print and digital books or magazines, video and audio productions, social media, and news interviews and press statements. So not only is ISIS, you know, maybe publishing miracles in Rumeya, but also ISIS fighters are tweeting out, you know, mentionings of different miracles that they've seen in the battlefields, and it's reaching a broader audience. So basically, he looked at a variety of different miracles, and he looked at the recurring themes in each. So the first was divine assistance in battle, so intervention by angels or people, prophets or angels coming in to help you. He also talks about animal intervention or animal behavior. So I found that really interesting. So like swarms of scorpions against the Soviets in Afghanistan, for example, or birds that would lead fighters in the right direction. He also talked about divine protection and also fighters that passed away smelling good or smelling of musk, maybe not decaying and smiling. So all of these things could be taken by fighters as miracles and be passed along in different avenues of social media. And it does a variety of things for the organization, right? So it can uplift morale. It can, you know, reinvigorate why you're in this fight to begin with. And generally, I think miracles benefit an organization. So they can either, you know, occur naturally, or people can perceive these in error as being miracles, or the organization itself can be deceptive. He spoke of an incident where an ISIS fighter had tweeted out a picture of another ISIS fighter that had passed, and he was smiling. And he basically said, you know, praise God, this person's a martyr. He's smiling even in death. And you could see in the picture that the fighter had an injured hand, and he was clearly smiling. He was clearly happy. Turns out that a different group basically said, you know, maybe he wasn't ISIS, maybe he was from the al-Nusra Front. So then ISIS production said, oh no, he was ours, you know, don't try to claim him. So they put out a video of this fighter, basically a martyrdom video, where he was saying and explaining why he was involved in this. It had interviews with family and friends, and there was a scene where he was holding his hand that was injured and he was smiling. You could see that whoever had posted the Twitter picture alleging it was a miracle had basically taken a still shot or screenshot of the video when he was alive. Mm-hmm. So they were, you know, deceiving people. Mm-hmm. Angie, I wanted to get your perspective on miracles in Islam and, you know, is this real, what ISIS is telling its fighters?
Yeah, so like I said before, I kind of had to brush up on my animal miracles in Islam course. So yeah, so this is not uncommon, but again, like we said before, the age of miracles ended after the Prophet Muhammad died. But, I mean, there are instances of divine intervention or things that people can interpret in their daily activities as something having having taken place by God's, by Allah's decree. So in terms of animals playing a role, I haven't really heard that much about it from, you know, average everyday Muslims. But in terms of the animal thing, it reminded me of an interview I read. So one of the foreign fighters, his name is Rashid Qasim. He's a French foreign fighter who was in Syria. He recently was killed, actually. So one academic interviewed him on his journey from France to Syria, and he was basically giving a play-by-play of everything that he encountered from his journey from France all the way to Syria. And he said in one of his encounters, the day or the morning that he was leaving France, it was like 3 or something in the morning, and it seemed like everything was kind of set in place, everything was set in motion for him to kind of go to Syria. The streets were very calm. And the one thing that gave him like a good sign was that there was a cat there, and he saw the cat, and he kind of interpreted that as a sign, as a thumbs up to go to Syria. So, I guess people will read into these signs what they will, but yeah.
Yeah, and I think it really resonates with a lot of people. I don't remember the specifics, but I do know that the researcher used an example of some kind of U.S. general that was in Fallujah and was asking for help from people, or, you know, maybe natives, and he really had to explain to them that, you know, spiders attacking you is not real, like, because it was so ingrained and indoctrinated mm-hmm. in the populations that people were very concerned that there was going to be giant spiders that would attack them.
So I know the latest issue of Rumeya, which is the English language magazine for ISIS, there were a bunch of sort of miracle-related stories in there. So in one, they were interviewing a military commander, and one of the questions is, can you tell us the miracles that Allah sent you to win, you know, this battle or something? And then in just about every issue, they have a part of the magazine where they note some of their martyrs, and in all of them, they claim that, he died smelling of musk, and they contort their faces so that they look like they're smiling in rigor mortis. Now that ISIS is losing on the battlefield, I think they're using this use of miracles and all that stuff to basically say, oh, look, God is on our side. It's inevitable. We'll win. So don't worry if we lose this city or this mm-hmm. battle. It's all taken care of. So we'll see how that works for them.
I think this panel was so interesting to me because it talked about, like, you know, very nuanced aspects of this messaging that I don't think people really hear much about. It was definitely news to me. Another panel that I sat in that I liked a lot was The Big, Bad, and the Dangerous Operational Sophistication and Public Perceptions of Terrorism by Clayton Webb and Nazli Abdan. So I think it's pretty much common knowledge that the risk from terrorism is inflated, and a lot of people think that it's a huge threat and it's a constant threat, but there's been many studies that prove that there's a myriad of other threats that are more dangerous to citizens throughout the United States. Like, I'm pretty sure falling, getting a cow to fall on you is more...
Well, it might be stampedes, too. It may not be just clumsy cows, but certainly like things like bee stings or dog attacks or things like that.
Yeah, are more common. So this went beyond just the perception of terrorism to the specific perception of threat by groups. So it looked at the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, and it looked at Boko Haram, and they found that people were more fearful of ISIS than Boko Haram. However, Boko Haram killed more people in 2014 and 2015 than ISIS. And they really wanted to dive into why this discrepancy existed. So they came up with a bunch of different hypotheses and really found that coordinated attacks by a group are perceived as more threatening. Attacks that span multiple countries are also perceived as more threatening. And groups that use social media to communicate with the public, all of these aspects influence the public's perception of fear. So when we look at terrorism, I think the major takeaway from this is terrorism is really where you're standing, right? So if you're, you know, in Boko Haram territory in Nigeria, obviously you're going to feel that threat and that pressure. But here in the United States, even though Boko Haram kills more people, we view ISIS as a bigger threat.
Mm-hmm. It's actually interesting you say that. I actually have a close friend of mine who is from Nigeria, who lived in an area that was ruled by Boko Haram. She went to undergrad with me, and she ended up joining the Muslim Students Association with me. She was like, it took her a lot of convincing to join, because she's like, I grew up, the only enemy I knew were Muslims, because that's what Boko Haram was kind of enforcing on us. Mm-hmm. But eventually when she got into our group and kind of learned, she's like, the Muslims here are completely different than in Nigeria. She never encountered Muslims other than Boko Haram. So mm-hmm. for her, obviously the issue was focus on where she was coming from, and that's how she perceived it.
Exactly. And I think these perceptions have real-world ramifications, right? I mean, beyond policy, who we focus on, what groups we perceive as more dangerous, also what's in the news, what the media is covering, which just kind of perpetuates this cycle.
Mm-hmm. And it's also, I think, similarities. So, like, an attack in Nigeria, I think even if it gets on the news and you see it, it doesn't look like where we live in many cases. Whereas an attack in Berlin or Nice looks very similar to the towns and cities that we are. And so it's easier to put yourself in the shoes of those victims or those places, and that probably increases the threat more as well. And certainly it goes without saying, a group like ISIS, it's their intent to make us feel probably more scared. Boko Haram probably doesn't care if we're frightened here in the United States of them quite as much as ISIS cares if we're sort of more concerned about them.
I mean, the whole premise, everything ISIS is really trying to do is kind of export terror, to have it so close that it's right on your phone, so they can kind of send that, and they want to be everywhere. So by sending these threats, the kill lists that they put out, everything that ISIS is doing is to kind of push out this terror and fear, and Boko Haram doesn't really do that. They're just focused on their specific area.
They want people in Nigeria and the surrounding countries to be terrified, but they don't
care about
outside of that. They don't care too much.
It's really interesting too, because then their lethality is really concentrated in a specific area, as opposed to ISIS that's hitting multiple countries and multiple targets, which contributes to that perception.
So we all sat in on a panel that was really interesting. It was called Foreign Fighters. The first speaker, Barak Mendelson, spoke about, the paper he was presenting was titled "The Foreign Fighter Dilemma, Explaining Variation in Foreign Fighter Recruitment in Syria and Iraq." So what he was, he basically broke down, he defined foreign fighter. His working definition was individuals that leave their home countries to join the fight in a foreign location and are not formally affiliated with any official force. So he really broke down the supply and demand aspect of foreign fighters for different terrorist groups. And he started off by breaking down a commonly held misperception about foreign fighters, that there's an assumption that armed non-state actors like ISIS or Al-Qaeda have a high demand for foreign fighters. And he said that that demand really isn't the reality, with the exception of ISIS. So he gave his insights and explained how foreign fighters can become a liability for some of these groups. And he looked at groups such as ISIS, the Nusra Front, Ahrar al-Sham, the People's Protection Units, or the YPG, and then he also looked at the Peshmerga, the Kurdish forces as well. And he broke down the supply and demand for all of these groups. For ISIS, they do have very high demand for foreign fighters. For groups like the Nusra Front, they actually want to be perceived as an entirely Syrian organization, so they don't want that many foreign fighters. And then the rest of the groups don't want foreign...
So what are the pluses and minuses of foreign fighters?
The pluses for foreign fighters is, and other panelists spoke to this, was that because the foreign fighters are coming from a different country, that someone who is from America going to Syria and Iraq, they can go in and basically kill the local population mercilessly, because they don't have any attachments to that specific locale or the citizens there. And as opposed to a local fighter, may not be able to kind of commit such atrocities against people from that specific town that they may know, etc.
And certainly the pro there is, we've kind of heard that, at least anecdotally in sort of open source reporting, right, that the foreign fighters are much more willing to sort of kill locals, they don't really care about locals, they're much more likely to brutalize people, that sort of thing.
Part of me wonders if psychologically foreign fighters are coming from, you know, a distant land, and like they just want to show their capability and devotion to the group.
And I mean, that is something else that, in terms of Western foreign fighters, especially converts, it's said that they're more fanatical because they feel like they need to prove themselves. Wasn't there some local ISIS fighters who were kind of rolling their eyes at sort of the Western converts because they're like, they're trying to be better Muslims than we are, right? And so that creates its own sort of tension between the locals versus the foreign fighters.
Well, there is a lot. Oh, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say that maybe the locals in some aspects are kind of forced into it, right? If ISIS is in your territory and it's either conform or face the repercussions, those people may not be interested in inflicting harm in general. No, it might be an act of desperation, as opposed to Westerners or foreign fighters that are going out of their way to travel
get there,
and to join.
Yeah. And to your point, Dean, when you were talking about Westerners versus the locals or foreign fighters in general, there is a lot of infighting, or there's a lot of cliques that end up being formed. So with ISIS, you see like the the group from China, the group from Europe, the group from America, etc. And it's funny because the Westerners tend to have this air of superiority among the locals. Like, oh, remember we read there was this blog that we ended up reading from a foreign fighter there. How it was like, oh, the way they do, they, he was not happy with the way they do things and how electricity kept getting cut off and there wasn't any running water.
I think his roommates, he didn't think they were clean enough and they didn't.
he had
a lot of complaints
So you see like cliques being formed. So the infighting can end up kind of decaying the group from within. That was kind of one of the aspects of the foreign fighters that Barak Mendelson touched on. One of the other panels that kind of ropes into this conversation that we just had was trying to assess whether the involvement of foreign fighters leads to more lethal conflicts. So the panelists looked at different conflicts historically, and they were able to find a relation between foreign fighters and an increase in battle death. So basically it kind of led to a doubling almost. But the moderator of the panel pointed out a flaw in that, basically saying, what if it's because the foreign fighters are coming in are proving to be a source of competition for the local fighters? So the local fighters have to kind of prove themselves, so they end up engaging in more increased violence. So I guess the authors of the paper were not able to distinguish, was it because the foreign fighter, because
the foreign fighters more deadly, or is it just make the conflict
deadlier just because they're because of their arrival? So that I thought was very interesting. On the same panel, they took a different take on this, but they were two of the individuals on the panel discussed the role that images play in extremist propaganda. So they specifically broke down propaganda used by ISIS in the Dabiq magazine, looking at all the 15 issues. And they were looking at marketing images and different strategies used by companies like Nike, etc., and the role that the images played. They assessed it on two things, how images have strong vectors of emotions or meaning. And they kind of broke it down into positives and negatives. So if an individual were to view an image of a decapitated head, does that lead to a positive emotion as opposed to a negative emotion? Mm-hmm. So that I thought was very interesting, but the results of their study is still very early.
It was interesting. Again, depending on where they can go with that research, I think it could be interesting to find out, since they were looking at it from an advertising point of view, a marketing point of view, what motivates somebody to action or, say, feelings of confidence. Right now, all they can kind of do is look at what messaging is going out and sort of what themes that ISIS, in this case, is trying to hit. They don't really have a measure for figuring out which of those messages work, right? Which advertisement for soda leads to an increase in sales? Which message from the terrorist group is going to make you want to join or conduct an attack? They can't do that second part yet.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting idea, and we'll see where they go with it.
And it seems like organizations in the past, even with, you know, AQAP's Inspire and Dabiq and Rumea now, they use infographics a lot, which is interesting to me, because here in our office, we're always like, infographics, the more the better, people understand them, they're visually pleasing, and terror organizations have been doing infographics for years.
Yeah, exactly. So the first panel that I sat on was called Non-State Groups, Strategic Decisions About Violence. And so that sounds like a really academic title. But really what they wanted to do was figure out, why do some groups use violence? When do they decide to use violence? And there's a lot of really interesting implications of that, whether you're interested in terrorism or criminal activity. So the first group I want to talk about looked at ISIS in their early years, before they were called ISIS, when they were called Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and looked about how they used violence against their own people, quote-unquote. So ISIS is a Sunni Muslim group, and one of the things they proclaim is that they exist in order to protect Sunni Muslims around the world, but in particular in Iraq and Syria. And yet, some of the first things they did when they came into being was began killing Sunni Muslims. And so it looked at sort of how they did that. And the Sunni Muslims that they frequently targeted first were senior elders, people of note in Sunni villages. They wanted to break up the existing sort of authority figures and sort of move into that vacuum that would take place there. So it started with something, their original strategy, they summed up by saying 9 bullets for the apostate, 1 for the crusader. And for ISIS, basically anyone who does not wholly agree with everything ISIS does is considered an apostate. You're not a real Muslim unless you're an ISIS Muslim. So they felt better to kill 9 of those than 1. And by crusader, they mean anyone who doesn't even pretend to be a Muslim. So anyone in the West, really, and almost anyone else. So their initial strategy was better to kill all these quote-unquote fake Muslims than worry about anyone else. And by doing that, their hope was that they would crush the tribal structures in Western Iraq and be able to take over. And to some extent, that did work in the years 2003 to 2007. That worked. They basically cowed everyone into submission. But what that also meant is that wasn't a good long-term strategy, because as soon as al-Qaeda in Iraq showed some weakness and the coalition forces, U.S.-led coalition forces, began really pushing back on them, many of the tribes rose in revolt. And sort of ISIS then went through several years of retreat, but they learned from that. And what they replaced that sort of force-only, punishment-only strategy with was sort of a mix of carrots and sticks. So while they still use a lot of violence in the tribes and towns that they take over, they began offering inducements if you played ball. And so it was much more of sort of brutal violence and also promises of taking part in their caliphate utopia, offering people who joined them slaves, wives, maybe houses from people that they have killed, that sort of thing. And so they moved to a much more sort of nuanced and sophisticated strategy.
It's interesting when you say that. I feel like another thing that would incentivize people to join is just basic protection and safety, knowing that if they join ISIS, then they can guarantee safety for themselves and their families. And they're with the only group that's kind of committing all these atrocities, so they know they're kind of untouchable.
Yeah, exactly. That's it too. And I know there's at least been some open source reporting that occasionally ISIS will have to kill some of its own members who are too, quote unquote, too brutal with the local population. And so you hear some of that as well. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that was a strategy they used with people who were sort of outside the group initially, but we're seeing reporting of them doing sort of a similar strategy even for recruits, for new members. So they entice some recruits to join with promises of, again, wives, homes, things like that. And then we also hear reports of them brutalizing, assaulting new recruits as well. And so there's sort of that mix of carrots and sticks there as well. So this second panel that presented was one that actually looked at Chicago street gangs. And what they wanted to do is determine when street gangs would engage in a turf war and when they would engage in a truce. And looking at Chicago street gangs, and I think it was the 1990s when they did this, the general status quo of gangs, even though we hear about them all the time and think about violence, generally they want to exist in a period where they're not fighting, because that's how you make money, right? And what they found was it would be times when they had what they called shocks to the system that would create opportunities for turf wars or truces. And that might be when the police arrest a leader or a housing block is torn down and sort of gang members are forced to move into new territory or something like that, which creates a change in the status quo. And what the researchers found is that sort of the more information that these gangs had about their status and the capabilities of sort of those around them really determined whether they would fight or form a truce. And the less they knew about sort of their capabilities as well as the capabilities of those around them, the more likely there was going to be a turf war. So what does that mean for terrorism? I would argue that probably very similar things happen when terrorist organizations go through big shocks. So when you hear that we've taken out sort of the number one, number two, number three leader in a group, a lot of times you'll get questions. Well, will there be retaliation? Is the group going to fall apart? Well, some of that kind of also depends on how the group understands itself and understands its risks that it might face.
Mm-hmm. It would be interesting if the researchers could identify not only, you know, the numerad of, you know, shocks that could hit the system, but also which shocks were most effective in causing groups to fight other groups.
Yeah.
Because I'm not sure in terms of policy, but I guess it's better if these groups are fighting each other, right, and occupying each other's time as opposed to targeting, you know, innocent civilians.
So, yeah, at least short term it is. I guess a flip side argument of that, because this is what happened in Syria in the early years of the civil war, is it wasn't uncommon to have some people say, well, it's great, ISIS and Al-Qaeda are fighting each other. Maybe we just want to keep that going. So in some ways, yes, it is good because it keeps them occupied. It also, however, basically trains them. And so I know you looked at this with Hezbollah. By doing that, they're getting combat training. So you're basically creating hardened warriors of those who live, right? But you're right in that if you can find the right shocks to the system that will cause disruption and weaken the capabilities, that might be better. And so there were some interesting findings in terms of sort of crime that the authors found that they think led to actually sort of reductions in turf wars and stuff like that. But I think that's probably more crime-focused, their findings, than sort of terrorism-focused, but it was good. So the second and last panel that I saw of the day was one related to chemical, biological, and nuclear terrorism. And there were two really interesting presentations on that. The first paper that was presented was called Avatars of the Earth, Radical Environmentalism, and Chemical, Biological, Radiological, and Nuclear Weapons. It was really interesting. So this was an attempt to do a threat assessment on radical environmentalist groups and what their intent and capability is in terms of using chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear weapons. And one thing I'll sort of note at the beginning of this that the authors repeated multiple times is that overwhelmingly within the environmental movement, even including the radical extremist environmental movement, the use of these weapons is rejected sort of all the time. But there is sort of a fringe of the fringe that does talk about the use of these weapons in some capability. And that's really what these authors were looking at. Generally, what they were looking at was in terms of sort of the likelihood of an attack, they were looking at sort of generally crude attacks by eco-radicalists. These folks generally operate under something called leaderless resistance. So that makes it hard to disrupt, and it also is hard to organize those groups. So that's kind of a plus and minus for them. Since they're hard to disrupt, they have a little more freedom of movement. Since they don't organize very well, it's hard to sort of collect capabilities together in one place. But one of the big concerns is that as technology advances, as more and more advanced technology transitions to the consumer market, that's going to lower the threshold to manufacture or acquire chemical, biological, or maybe even radiological weapons. So the author saw the most likely course of action, a low-level chemical attack, and a radiological attack, sort of the least likely course of action. And so within the movement, there was one group that they thought was most likely to be open to using sort of, let's say, biological weapons. And that was something they called the Green Anarchist Movement. They're the most likely to have the intent, still don't have much in the way of capabilities. But this movement, again, at the fringe of the fringe, sort of sees humanity as almost like a virus or a cancer on the face of the earth. And so if you view human impact in that way, all of a sudden it doesn't become unthinkable to think, well, when we have a bacteria or a virus or a cancer, we use chemotherapy, we use drugs to eradicate that disease, maybe we need to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. So there they identified some possible intent, but again, capability is a little difficult. This fed in really nice to another paper, which was presented by a researcher at the University of Maryland's START program, and they announced a new database coming out soon, and it's the database goes by the name of the Profiles of Incidents Involving CBRN, which is Chemical, Biological, Radiological, Nuclear, and Non-State Actors Database, and it has the appropriate acronym POISON. And what they're doing is they've collected 544 incidents of this sort of terrorism between 1990 and 2015. Now, they excluded hoaxes, they excluded criminal activity, and they excluded events by state actors, so countries that do these sorts of events. And once this database gets released, it'll allow you to sort of do all sorts of very interesting searches to look for trends, patterns, that sort of thing.
And for those of you who are looking for any other database resources, START is really great. We've done other podcasts talking about the Global Terrorism Database, which is basically a collection of all terrorism incidents that they can get their hands on, which is probably the most complete terrorism database that's in existence currently. They have other databases like PIRUS, which is Profiles in Radicalization, that look at individual radicalizing variables on different subjects. So, you know, their education level, if they were employed, if they moved around a lot.
Yeah, we strongly recommend working with the University of Maryland. Folks, they have tons of great data, lots of good analysis going on, so we recommend them highly. And the last thing that I want to talk about with this panel is researchers also did, they were sort of looking at threats from chemical, biological, radiological weapons, trying to look over the next 10 years at what the range of threats would be. And they did this really interesting methodology called, I think it was over the horizon analysis. And they didn't assess these threats, but they just wanted to identify what the threats were and then leave it up to analysts or researchers afterwards to do an assessment of those. And they identified sort of four really interesting trends that they think make chemical, biological, radiological, CBRN, threats more likely in the next 10 years. So the first was the advancement of technologies and the spread of that technology getting in, becoming sort of off the shelf and sort of commercially available. We've seen that with things like 3D printing, but you're soon going to be able to do that with biological agents and actually sort of print and sort of create those. So that is one issue, more technology. Second is sort of the increasing educational capability around the world. The world population is getting more and more educated with the internet. It's easier and easier to just get more information. So that's normally a good thing, but when you combine that with increasing political and social instability, the authors argued that that raises the threat capabilities overall, right? You have more people sort of disenfranchised, perhaps motivated to some sort of action, and increased educational ability and increased availability of technology, plus the shift of the chemical industry away from the West and towards less stable parts of the world. So right now it is possible in some parts of the world to send a particular chemical formula you're interested in, send that to manufacturing plants in other parts of the world. They'll manufacture it and send it back to you. Mm-hmm. Now, there are some controls in place to make sure that you're not creating nerve gas, but what you can do is, at least the authors were arguing, that you can do some fairly small modifications to those chemical formulas so that it falls outside of the definition of, let's say, nerve gas. And you're not entirely sure if some of these manufacturing companies are doing some sort of due diligence to find out what the lethality is of this stuff that they're creating is. So that's one of the concerns.
And it's really difficult to regulate that industry. I know that the DEA and different drug administrations are still looking at how those companies are producing fentanyl and other types of drugs, because as soon as, you know, they get one compound on the list of like a Schedule 1 or 2 substance, they're changing the compound slightly so it's legal, you know, per se. So it's kind of this game where they're always chasing these formulas to add to the list.
Yeah. And that leads right into the last threat that they identified, which was criminal organizations are becoming more interested in chemical agents and synthesizing chemical agents. Look, you know, why spend the time in a, you know, growing a poppy field or growing marijuana plants when if you can synthesize that same sort of drug compound in a basement or in a shed somewhere, right? I no longer need acres and acres of plants. I can just manufacture it. And at least in theory, it's harder to find that. And you control, you don't have to worry about weather. You don't have to worry about all these other variables, right? You can just produce stuff. Well, the chemical makeup, as you implied, Paige, the chemical makeup of some narcotics is not that far off from poisons. In many cases, you know, it is poison, right? So what we're seeing is criminal organizations are actually developing this capability to manufacture chemical agents. Mm-hmm. And whether it's, you know, an opioid or a nerve agent, developing, you know, synthesizing a chemical is synthesizing a chemical, right? I mean, if you've developed the process, you're kind of halfway there. So those four things or five things sort of all combined, the authors thought, were leading to sort of a much more dangerous environment.
Mm-hmm. And that really makes sense. I know, you know, we know terrorist organizations coordinate with criminal organizations to, you know, acquire weapons and to acquire, you know, fraudulent documents. So it only makes sense that if, you know, there was a supply and a demand market there, they could acquire those chemicals from crime organizations too.
Yeah. So that wrapped up our ISA overview. Overall, what did you guys think of the conference?
I thought it was great. I thought we had a lot of good takeaways. We made a lot of really great connections and interacted a lot with academics. I think a lot of academics put so much time and work into their papers for it to kind of fall on deaf ears sometimes. And it's nice when practitioners go to these events and try to really implement some of the findings.
Yeah, I agree. I thought there were some gems in this conference that we kind of hit. It was very interesting, very diverse group of people, people coming from all over the world. So it was good to connect with people coming from different areas and kind of talk to them about their different areas of expertise. So it was a very good experience for all of us, I think.
Awesome.
So thank you very much. Hopefully we will be back next year talking about the next conference. Other than that, thank you very much for tuning in, and we'll talk to you again.
Again, all links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njhomelandsecurity.gov. If you have any ideas or topics for future episodes, please contact us on Twitter at NJOHSP or email us at intelunclass@njohsp.gov. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe to Intelligence Unclassified.